It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk with the woman behind Santa Fe's perennial destination restaurant. How has Cafe Pascual's kept the quality and the zest up for 20 years? Its creator, Catherine Cagle, tells all. Her book is Cooking with Cafe Pascual's. Anya von Bremsen, author of The New Spanish Table, tells us about what could be the world's most coddled paprika, Spain's smoky pimenton. Commentator Julie Hauserman tells us how Florida's put her tax dollars to work in the kitchen. And we learn what the Halloween witch was before the misogynists started their smear campaign from beer historian Alan Eames. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. Jane and Michael write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, Cody, Wyoming is a really popular tourist town. You know, there's that fabulous Buffalo Bill Museum there, which is utterly spectacular if you're interested in anything Western. The problem with Cody is that virtually everything there is very expensive because it's a tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. We found one wonderful restaurant that is very cheap, a little bit off the beaten path, like two blocks away from the main drag in Cody, that serves really terrific Southwestern and Western food at bargain prices. And that in Cody is a rare find.
And we've never seen anyone except ourselves who wasn't a local there.
What's the place called?
The place is called Noon Break, and it's a little breakfast and lunch place. The menu is mostly Southwestern, a lot of Mexican specialties. I'll tell you, the salsa that accompanies the tortilla chips that you get with every meal is so redolent of fresh garlic. It sort of opens up your head right away. And then what you get, there are all kinds of chili-based dishes. The two fundamental chilies themselves are like regular red chili or what they call Code 10 chili. Code 10 chili is a classic kind of pork, like a green chili stew made with pork.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like Texas chili at all. It's a real green chili stew with like chunks of pork. And it is pretty darn hot. I mean, kind of eye-opening, sinus-clearing hot.
This sounds really delicious.
It's great. And it's, you know, it's just like this really humble little lunchroom with license plates on the wall and a few
license plates from all over. I mean,
right.
one from every state at least.
And, you know, gewgaws of, you know, various
right.
things. But it's very kind of down home. And as Michael said, just incredibly inexpensive, which for Cody is, you know, is a very nice find.
Do they do chili for breakfast?
Yes, they do. Of course, you can have huevos rancheros. You can have they have breakfast wraps, you know, with chili in them. But I'll tell you, actually, the thing that I love for breakfast at Noon Break is not chili-based. It's biscuits and gravy. It's a real nice kind of creamy sausage pepper gravy on top of the biscuits. You know, it's like 8 million calories on a plate.
Healthy, is it good.
Yes.
And you know what else
you,
they yes. have? They have great blue corn enchiladas and pozole. Do you like pozole?
I love pozole. That's the
hominy soup.
Hominy style corn. Yeah, it looks
like very
popped corn almost.
Very humble kind of, but it's kind of soul food. I mean, it's Southwestern soul food.
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
delicious.
Some of that and that pork green chili wouldn't be a bad idea.
Oh, yeah.
Not
yeah.
bad
oh, yeah.
at all.
Uh-huh. Hey, guys, thank you.
Thanks,
bye.
Yeah, bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know, go to the website, splendidtable.org. An email came in from a listener. She tried apples that she'd not seen before in a pie, and she ended up with applesauce in a gooey, goopy crust. So her question was, which of the new apples in the market are good for pie? Well, we're in prime apple season, and old types are making big comebacks. Now, you've still got the Granny Smiths. They're the great standbys for great pie. And by the way, forget the Golden Delicious. They're totally tasteless. But I'd like you to try these comeback apples and some of the new ones. Now, for apple pie, you need a firm fruit that's going to hold its shape in cooking. Check these out. Chestnut Crab, Connell Red, Fireside, Harrelson, Honeycrisp, Keepsake, Liberty, Northern Spy and Prairie Spy, Regent, and then the great old-timer Rhode Island Greening. Well, we've got the whole list of cooking apples from pie to sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Paprika's going transcendental. For we Americans, paprika has turned from mindless coloring into brilliant spice. I mean, we're actually getting picky. We're learning about nuances and learning that origin matters. One person who's tracked paprika's rise at one of its important sources is food writer and cookbook author Anya van Bremsen. Now, Anya's been researching Spain's food scene since the 1980s. You've seen her work in national magazines, and you've heard her here on the show. Her new book is The New Spanish Table. Hey, Anya, welcome.
Good to be here.
So, Anya, we are not talking here Hungarian paprika. We're not talking the tasteless powder. We're talking Spanish paprika. But where is this coming from, and how is it processed?
Spanish paprika is really one of those really special ingredients, and I think America is hooked. I've been traveling all over the country, and chefs and consumers are just, you know, going crazy for it. Spanish paprika, called Pimentón de la Vera, with its own denomination of origin, the first pepper to be ever awarded, this comes from the Extremadura region, the kind of formerly destitute region where a lot of the conquistadores came from. In the middle of Extremadura, which is western Spain, border with Portugal, harsh, severe, there is a valley called La Vera, which is incredibly fertile. And there they grow lovely, lovely peppers. And the Spanish paprika is a unique product, very handcrafted. The peppers are harvested by hand in the fall. And then comes the important part. They are smoked for 2 weeks over smoldering oak or holm oak, which are trees native to Extremadura, so that they attain this really deep, penetrating smokiness, you know, not like a jolt of liquid smoke, but really something extraordinarily, you know, leathery, you know, with that special unique tang. And that's not it. Then the peppers arrive to processing factories, and then they're ground for about 8 hours in stone mills.
8 hours? That's
interesting. 8 hours in stone mills in temperature-controlled environment that doesn't sort of erase and delete their
so they're
color
not getting
flavor,
hot
actually
the
no they're not, and that's the secret, because when you take a pinch of the Spanish pimenton of the paprika, it's like talc. It's really silky, you know. The Hungarian paprika is kind of coarse and it doesn't really dissolve properly, and it just adds, you know, something you sprinkle over deviled eggs. And this paprika is just profoundly, deeply smoky. If you want to replicate the flavor of barbecue, use it as an instant rub on, you know, chicken or meat. As a marinade, it really enhances, you know, it gives this kind of tangy, you know, leathery punch to so many dishes. And in Spain, you know, if people ask me what is the most Spanish ingredient, if I was stranded on a desert island and I just wanted the whiff of Spain, this would be the ingredient that I would take with me. Because, you know, you think of chorizo sausages, it flavors it. You think of iconic soups like sopa de ajo, the garlic soup with cured ham and a poached egg. You know, that gives it that kind of rusty sort of brick color and that unmistakably smoky aroma. This is like a Castile in the jar in a heartland Spain, really sort of the central plains where, you know, think of Don Quixote. Really, you know, España profunda, as I say, amazing, amazing ingredient, and Americans are just wild for it.
So now, when you talk about this paprika, is it always one flavor? I mean, is it traditionally sweet? Is it traditionally hot?
No, when the peppers are picked, they're sorted into three categories. The most commonly used is dulce or sweet. Then you have agridulce, which is kind of bittersweet. And then you have picante, which is hot. The Spanish palate, I have to say, is not, they're really not into spicy flavors. You shouldn't be confused with Mexican cuisine, even though they're the ones that brought capsicum peppers and chilies from the New World. You know, they really didn't take to the spicy flavors. So the picante one is used very sparingly, just when you want kind of that slightly piquant edge.
So how can we use it?
I love it as a marinade, for instance, for a pork loin or roast chicken. You just kind of combine it with some pounded crushed garlic, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of salt, maybe a touch of oregano, and just rub it on, you know, anything that you want to roast. You can make a dry rub with it for steaks, for instance, that you're going to grill. It's great to add to paella, to simulate, you know, the smokiness of the grill over which paella is traditionally cooked. And then you can just, most of the Spanish bean stews have a touch of this paprika. It really, wherever you want, you know, a touch of this reddish color and a hint of smokiness, just add a pinch. The only thing, when you're cooking with it, the Spanish are adamant about not heating it over, you know, 10 seconds, because they claim that it turns bitter. So when you add the paprika to cook dishes, especially to, you know, oil that is heating, take it off the heat immediately.
I see. So it would go in toward the end.
A very delicate ingredient. It's not, you know, it's not your kind of sturdy Hungarian stuff.
Anya, it sounds fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll be hooked.
Anya van Bremsen is author of The New Spanish Table, and anybody who's riled over Hungarian paprika, just send the emails to Anya, please. Anyway, Anya left us with a simple way to try out smoked Spanish paprika. The recipe is smoky mashed potatoes. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletters. We have two for you, the Classic Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, our new Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Every week, you get a new recipe, and as usual, both newsletters are free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the making of Santa Fe's beloved Café Pascual's, the Halloween witch as brew goddess, and art as pasta. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, if you go to Santa Fe and don't eat at Café Pascual's, you've missed a local gem. Now, here's a place in a prime tourist town where you could get away with doing ordinary, because most of the customers are tourists. They don't come back. But in 20 years of business, Pascual's has never turned out ordinary. From the house-made chorizo and local red and green chili to the Thai curry, they always shine. Well, the power behind the place is Catherine Cagle. Her latest book is Cooking with Cafe Pasquale's. Catherine, welcome.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be here, Lynn.
You know, cookbook author Deborah Madison, who now lives in the Santa Fe area, you know what she says about Cafe Pasquale?
No.
She said, you guys have never lost the heart of the food. You know, you have to have a real identification with the food to be able to do this.
Oh, absolutely. It was all about food. My grandmother had a produce stand at the Housewives Market in Oakland, and my mother's family had a market in Sacramento, California. And back in the old days, in the old country, they were vintners, and it's all about food.
But you're not from Santa Fe.
No. I grew up in Berkeley, California, in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fantastic time. My parents had a beach house that my father's passion is basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So that required at least 18 people and their others. So we did about 100 meals a weekend, my mother and myself. And it was really a lot of fun. So there was the beach and basketball and hiking, and we were always looking for mushrooms and, you know, going clamming, and it was all right there. So it was a very rich food experience growing up.
So how did you start cooking in Santa Fe then?
Well, I came to Santa Fe because Santa Fe just sacked me. The first time I came here, I just went, I'm home. And I never thought I'd leave a coast.
So how did the food start?
Well, I knew two people, and I said, why don't we throw a Chinese feast? You invite 12 people, and I'll make 13 dishes, because the tradition is you make one more mm-hmm. dish than there are people.
Uh-huh.
And they did. It was like the third day I was in Santa Fe. And someone at that party said, you should cater. And I thought, that sounds like an interesting idea. So the next day I went out and got my tax number, and one thing led to another. And then I walked into Dudlitz's shop across from Pasquale's.
Yeah.
And met Theo Raven, the owner. And she said, see that restaurant across the street? Go buy it. And she was so sure that I said, okay.
I will.
You know, that's the biggest ingredient in starting a restaurant is naivete. You have to have a lot of naivete.
That's true. Yeah, Catherine, this book, it really feels like a family cookbook. It's all about your staff and the foods that they make, the dishes they make that are on the menu. And it just feels like everybody has a vested interest in this. Now, this is not an easy thing to pull off. So how do you deal with employees? What are your policies that you create this atmosphere?
Well, we say we will invest in you if you invest in us. So we have an incentive program, and that is we will pay insurance, and we will also pay for paid vacations. This is pretty rare in the restaurant industry because it has high turnover. But we, really believe that why keep rotating talent? When you've got talent, let's all develop it together. And the core group, we've all been working together for at least 20 years.
Really?
Years. Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about the direct contrast to this atmosphere in the kitchen. Have you read Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential?
Well, I got through two chapters. And then I was so upset that he was going to make a big success over making the kitchen into a war zone. The people got that served up to them, and they thought, oh, wow, is this really the world of the restaurant? And it can be. It certainly can. It's an incredibly brutal atmosphere in any case. I mean, there's overspray from the dishwashing. You know, the floor is wet. The ovens are hot. People are moving very fast. It's a high adrenaline environment. But when you throw in what he was talking about, which is animosity towards patrons and drugs and attitude, wow. I just have to honestly say, it's the only book in my whole life I ever walked over to a garbage can and threw away because I was so angry and upset that this is what the spotlight was going to be on, this kind of attitude.
So it's everything you've worked against. and they're exactly. sitting there.
And yeah. I, you know, it's not really about Anthony Bourdain. He was recording the environments he'd worked in. But
they exist. They absolutely exist.
No, I would say it's honestly probably the majority, and it's really a sad story. Very sad.
Mm. How long will Cafe Pascual go on, do you think?
Oh, my goodness. Well, as long as it's fun and we all have the energy to do it, I'm sure. All those things. It's like it's an interesting mix, you know. I was one day at the door, and this elderly gentleman said to me, "Are you the owner?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I work at the Santa Fe Institute. Do you know what that is?" And I said, "Well, yes. What I think it is a think tank for scientists from all over the world who come here, but it's the whole idea is to think outside the box."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "That's absolutely right." He said, "And I've been studying Cafe Pascual's for 20 years, and I have come to a conclusion of how and why it works. And I'm wondering if you know why it works." And I said, "Well, a lot of hard work and a lot of luck." And he said, "Actually, no. After 20 years of study, I figured out what it is." I said, "Well, please tell me." He goes, "Magic." Isn't that great?
I love it. From a scientist who thinks outside the box.
Right.
Catherine Cagle, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Catherine Cagle is the executive chef and founder of Cafe Pascual's in Santa Fe. She's author of Cooking with Cafe Pascual's. Now, Catherine's given us a splashy recipe for gatherings. There's lots of showmanship and no meat. Now, you'll find sugar pumpkins filled with vegetable stew in chipotle cream sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Beer historian Alan Ames has been called the Indiana Jones of beer. Now, he goes after beer lore no matter where it may be. He's been held at gunpoint by gorillas and has survived an assortment of jungle diseases. But one of the running themes in his research is women and beer. I've got Alan on the phone. Alan, welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
I am good. I am good. So, Alan, where has the work taken you lately?
Well, most recently I became, shall we say, bewitched.
Mm-hmm.
There are two wonderful words. We say someone is bewitching, and we also use the word glamorous. And glamorous, you may know, is a medieval word that means to have had a spell cast upon you. And interestingly enough, by someone radiantly beautiful. I became interested in the interplay between our notion of a witch, a Halloween witch, and the Brewster. In ancient times, witches were instantly recognizable because of their beauty. They were all young and fair, the sirens, for example, that troubled Ulysses and his crew. And only recently, and in fact, I couldn't find before the age of Industrial Revolution an image of a witch that looks like what we think of as a Halloween witch. It was a brand new invention.
Huh.
So this is off we go to Europe again, and trying to look at the burning times when tens of thousands of women were horribly killed. And I found that in these ancient court records in places like Scotland and Wales and England and Germany, that if a woman had an occupation, it was as midwife / Brewster, or cure-all, herbalist, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And what emerged was this notion of a woman living on the outskirts of town, not a member of the newly emerging surgeon and medical community, not a tax-paying maker of beer to the new brewer's guilds, which the church was involved in, selling beer, being an herbalist, putting all kinds of things into beer to make it even more mood-altering and attractive. And eventually these women got into trouble. They were targeted by a misogynist church who at that point in time mistrusted all things female. And so all of a sudden we were given this picture of a woman who was very old, a woman who had a very tall conical hat, which I discovered was a device developed by Brewsters around the 10th century. women would go to these enormous church fairs where you'd have hundreds of yards of booths lined up with people selling all kinds of things. Well, how could she be seen above the crowd?
Oh.
Roosters began wearing these tall conical hats, 5 and 6 foot tall steepled hats. What's the other image we have? She has a cauldron. And looking at these cauldrons, looking literally at thousands of pictures from storybooks of witches with their cauldrons, these cauldrons are all brew vessels, great round, fat-bottomed pots with narrow necks. And why does a woman have a cat? Well, of course, there's always the witch's cat, and it's because she has to protect her grain stores, her most valuable asset.
From rats and mice.
And lastly, the broomstick, the besom, the broomstick was the image of medieval and post-medieval women's husbandry. It was the scepter of her reign in the household. And I have seen throughout Africa, Asia, and particularly in South America, tribal women, when they have beer to sell, they stick a broom in the road. And if the beer they're selling is made with fruit or has some other distinguishing characteristic, then that broom will be garlanded with colored flowers. If it's, say, chicha, corn beer, or masato beer, the broom will be garlanded with white flowers. And then looking further into it again, why the broomstick? I know that looking at 11th and 12th century pictures of alewives, if a woman at that time period in our history had extra ale to sell. Remember, it was liquid bread. Her family had to have it. She brewed and she baked.
Right, right.
If she had surplus beer to sell, she'd stick her broom out in the road.
Huh.
Then I discovered that as time went by, the broom found a permanent place over the front door of the cottage. And then as villages turned into small cities, some enterprising woman cantilevered the broomstick out over the street as a permanent sign, and by the way, the first trade sign in Western Europe.
Really?
Yes. So those were the components that gave us this image of an unsavory woman. And these women were really persecuted for no other reason than what was perceived as being the dark side, the women's mystery of beer making.
So, Alan, do you see any effect, you know, from these women and the kinds of things that they brewed with modern-day breweries?
Yes, I do. There's a brewery in the south of England that's making some wonderful beers. Some, I understand, are finding their ways to our shores. There's a brewery calling itself Witchwood, and they have a beer called Witchcraft. They make a number of brews that celebrate this connection with women.
Mm.
Also, I'm seeing more and more women appear in the brewing industry as brewsters, which is heartwarming to me.
So it goes full circle. Hey, Alan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Alan Eames is a beer historian and author of The Secret Life of Beer. What if government used your tax dollars on things that mattered, like promoting good food? Commentator Julie Hauserman has encouraging news on this front from Florida.
I just got a tax notice in the mail, and it's a doozy. You try not to think about where that money's going. Bombs, voting machines that don't work, bridges to nowhere, and levees that break just when you need them most. But being a culinarian in Florida, the state that spent many, many tax dollars trying to pick a president in 2000, I have cause to celebrate. It turns out that we are the only state that has its own designated chef. He works for the Department of Agriculture and travels around to promote Florida food. And get this, it seems that my tax dollars are actually at work successfully. Our Florida chef, Justin Timoneri, is now officially the nation's seafood king. He and his partner in Team Florida won the Great American Seafood Cook-Off this summer in New Orleans, beating out 20 other really good chefs from all over the country. The Florida team even beat a chef from Maryland who stuffed jumbo lump crab meat into a crispy soft-shell crab, which is a menu item I had to read twice to believe it. Justin's co-creator on the Florida team is the man who cooks dinner most nights for the president's brother. His name is Joshua Butler, and he's Governor Jeb Bush's executive chef. These are young guys with passion and talent. Joshua's 29 and Justin's 30. Neither has any formal chef school training. Both started as dishwashers in Tallahassee restaurants and worked their way up. Florida is a tricky food state when you're talking about regional cuisine. We're the state of early bird specials, a state with a flamingo as a mascot when flamingos don't even live here. We don't have some obvious local dish like New England pot roast or Vermont syrup or Chicago pizza or Philly cheesesteaks. We're schizophrenic, with Cuban pastelitos and Caribbean jerk down south and fried mullet cheese grits and hush puppies up north. We actually had a fight in the state legislature this year over designating the official state pie. North Florida lawmakers insisted on sweet potato pie, and South Florida ones fought for key lime. Key lime won, even though we don't grow key limes here commercially, but we do have a commercial sweet potato crop. Go figure. In their winning entry, Team Florida took the state's greatest assets to full advantage: fresh Atlantic and Gulf seafood, citrus, and sunshine. Their dish was crispy pan-seared snapper with passion fruit cream, along with a Florida citrus salad with Gulf shrimp and green mango jam. It was fusion, just like Florida's mixed-up population. They used shaved fennel and jicama and Thai red curry, along with Florida fish and fruit. Joshua tried the dish out on Governor Bush, Columba Bush, and two visiting Vatican priests at the mansion, and they pronounced it perfect. As far as my tax dollars go, our Department of Agriculture chef is a bargain, making just $35,000 a year. But what a return on our investment. He got Florida on the map at the seafood cook-off. He goes around the state meeting growers to find out what's fresh and best. He visits schoolchildren and teaches them about healthy regional ingredients. If there's anything that might be able to get our fractured country on the same page, it might just be food and the local pride and camaraderie that goes along with it. My tax dollars at work in the kitchen.
Julie Hauserman is a freelance writer who pays her taxes in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question's about Halloween. Why do we beg for food on Halloween with the threat of trick or treat? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, why do we beg for food on Halloween with the threat of trick or treat? It's about a black and white religious view of a much more complex collection of customs. Now, Every culture believes that the veil between the living and the dead is thinnest when the harvest is over and the dead of winter is setting in. Now, fire has always marked this time. The custom of families taking home embers from this ritual fire to keep their hearth going probably led to our ritual of the jack-o'-lantern. Long before Christianity, the Celts believed that the dead roamed out of tombs at this time. Now, they weren't necessarily evil. They were just old ones coming home for a visit. But hungry spirits got greedy, so you appeased them with foods. And you shared the harvest wealth. You had to convince them that they weren't missing out on any profits. People then called this time Samhain. Well, Christianity came along and stuck labels of good and evil on the customs. Perspective went from accepting seasonal change to protecting yourself from a judgmental God. Well, this was when going from door to door, dressed up like the evil, in quotes, spirit started. Better to bribe the stand-in spirit with food than to risk the trick that it could play. And Halloween went from agrarian celebration to playing out religious beliefs to a Walmart holiday. It's time for your calls. You can pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252. We have Victor calling from Los Angeles. Hey, Victor, what do you want to talk about?
My question has to do with orange marmalade that has been in storage in sealed jars, professionally, commercial marmalade.
Right.
That I've acquired primarily from one friend who did a tremendous amount of traveling and knew that I liked orange marmalade. And would bring jars of it back from various parts of the world that he traveled to.
What a great friend.
Yeah. And, well, the goal was to one day gather a group of people and make up some really good coffee and some good English muffins.
Oh, that sounds great.
For those that want scones, and open up these jars and sample them. And unfortunately, this friend of ours died a couple years ago.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry.
And so he won't be partaking of it. But the question then came, are these safe to eat? They've been sealed this whole time. They've never, you know, the seal has never been cracked on the
right,
lid.
Right, right.
And are they safe to open and eat?
How long has it been?
Years.
The existing wisdom from people like the USDA about jam and marmalade and things like that is a year.
Hmm.
And the thing is, even though there's a lot of acid in marmalade, which tends to, you know, help a lot in killing off possibly harmful bacteria, deterioration does set in. And, I hate to say this because obviously what went into this collection is far more than solely, you know, curiosity for you.
Right.
But I think it might be a little dicey.
Okay.
And it's not worth, you know, so many of the things that can happen to canned foods are not something that you can smell or you can taste or you can cook away.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be very dangerous. And, you know, I hate, this is when I start sounding like the food police, and I hate that. But I'd be kind of leery. I'm sorry. Oh, Victor.
Well, that's fine.
But you know what? You've got a great collection.
Yeah.
It's like the Mustard Museum, you know, in Wisconsin. I mean, the many of these things are just sitting there because they're so interesting. And
yeah.
You've got a great memory.
Okay.
Hey.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
All right.
Take
All
care.
Right. Bye.
It's so tricky, isn't it? Because we think when things are canned or they're jarred that they will last forever. Or we do what I do, which is I'm saving it for a special moment. And then you suddenly realize it's over before you ever got a chance to taste it. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Jeffrey calling from Seattle. Is this the Jeffrey, the man of great party giving?
That's me. Hi, Lynn.
I thought it might be you. It's getting to be that time.
It is already. Yeah, I'm the retro cocktail party guy calling in for help once again.
For listeners who don't know Jeffrey, we hear from Jeffrey just about every year, and Jeffrey does the most splendiferous parties, and they all have themes. Well, okay, Jeffrey, what's the theme this year?
Well, this year has been a long-time party ambition for me, but since I've finally been to Paris as an adult, now I can do cocktail mais oui.
I love it.
I know. It's great. And everything, of course, needs to be filtered through, you know, kind of a time machine, a 1950s style cocktail party.
Oh, this is going to be great. So the beginning of the Bar American. Well, no, I think the Bar American existed.
It was established.
It was already well established.
But American in Paris, the movie, and all these things. I mean, Paris was huge in the 50s.
Oh, this is going to be so great. So what kinds of things are you going to be doing?
Well, the drinks are, you know, drinks and food are both pretty easy for this. There's a lot to choose from, so I need to focus a bit.
Yeah.
Drink-wise, there'll be a lot of champagnes on the menu, like the French 75, champagne cocktail, as well as some Dubonnet and pastis and so forth.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Now, food-wise, though, I've decided I want to make this the year of the canapé. And
Okay. Where
did all the canapés go? My vintage cocktail books... 1949 to 1959, just love it because it's all about appearances, the canapé. And
right.
then, like, by 1960, New Year's Day, they were on deliberation. They didn't like the canapé. They speak of it in very discouraging tones.
Well, I think because it was considered to be very fussy food
mm-hmm.
and a more modern take was coming in, cleaner flavors, easier, and there was something else. There wasn't as much help in the kitchen.
No, exactly.
Because they're a pain in the neck, you know, as you know, to
well,
make.
Well, I haven't made them yet, but I'm hoping to have four or five that I can make. Preferably cold.
Okay. Yeah, because you don't want to be serving anything hot in this situation.
No, it's too crazy.
So is this the question you are asking me?
Yes.
Okay.
Canapé help.
The woman who gave up canapés for Lent a long time ago. Okay. A couple of things come to mind.
All right.
And I'm just thinking about the great French classics, but they're not... Well, let me think for a minute.
I mean, if you want to, you know, go off the topic a little bit, then please do, if you have other
well,
ideas.
Well, one thing that's really great to do... And the thing is, I think I had it in Paris for the first time I had it, is slices of cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to do is salt that and roll it up in paper towels. You can do this a day ahead to get rid of all that excess moisture. So the essentially you've got about a quarter inch thick slice. And if you use those, I hate the term, burpless cucumbers, the ones that do not have many seeds, they're better for this.
Okay.
And the idea is that on that goes a daub of a creamy cheese. It could be a goat cheese or whatever that you have mixed just a little bit of onion and or scallion or chives.
Okay.
And salt and pepper. And then on top of that goes a little curl of smoked salmon.
Okay, great.
And that's really, I mean, you can assemble that a bit ahead. One of the great classics, too, that has been done forever is the leaves of Belgian endive, and they have to be perfect, pristine leaves. And it's the daub of sour cream topped with a daub of caviar. Now, obviously, it doesn't have to be beluga. It could be the red caviar. It could be the black caviar. But it can be something that's relatively inexpensive. And that... because you've got the bitter of the leaf, the richness of the sour cream, and then you've got the saltiness of the caviar. It's really a dynamite combination.
Great.
So that's cold. That's easy.
Mm-hmm.
There were classics that were done for years, like mushrooms a la grec, which you can serve on toothpicks. And these are small button mushrooms that you cook in a mixture of olive oil and white wine vinegar and white wine and garlic and tomato and saffron and fennel. And you let them then sit in that mixture. It's like cooking them in the marinade. You let them sit, and you can go into charcuteries all over Paris, and you will see, in the chilled section, great pots of these that are then, you take them home with you, but the idea is you drain the mushrooms, and you just stick attractive toothpicks in them.
Okay, and so there's not like an olive or anything else?
No, it is just this, and it is utterly delicious, and do it two or three days ahead.
Okay.
And then let it drain overnight, so you've got, you don't have drippies, and they're just fabulous.
Wonderful.
Now, another thing that's fun to do, it's from the south of France. Now you've got me on a roll.
I'm
walking through all my time in France now and thinking of what I ate. There's a blend that you do. You take olive oil, garlic, and anchovies and black pepper, and you stew that until the garlic is falling apart. But a lot of anchovies. And then you take that and you squeeze lots of lemon juice into it. And the anchovies no longer are strong, but they're mellow and rich. And the garlic is not garlic hit you over the head. It's also mellow and rich. And you take little pieces of baguette that you've toasted, just a mouthful.
Yep.
And you smear that over it.
Okay.
And you can top that with just a few fresh leaves of parsley. And that you serve at room temperature.
Great.
It's like an anchovy butter. But a Provençal anchovy butter, because there's no butter in it. It's the butter of Provence. It's olive oil.
Right.
You know the other great thing to do? Now, this is newer, though. Although the 60s was the era of the terrible problems, I think, in North Africa. And before that, North Africa was very much in... Yeah, you could do this. It's sort of Moroccan carrots. And I had this in the south of France as well. And in Paris, but it was a long time ago. Anyway, angle-cut carrots, they're just a mouthful, that you slow roast with olive oil and hot paprika and cumin and coriander. And then you serve them at room temperature.
Okay.
And lots of... And salt, obviously. So that's a few, tiny boiled potatoes. You cut the bottom so they'll stand, and you cut them in half, and then you top that with something like a lemon butter. And they're served cold, and they're delicious. And then my all-time favorite, which is buttered radishes. And this was an aperitif that, gosh, they were serving constantly, which was you can take icicle radishes or you can take just red radishes and have them, and you have soft sweet butter, really good butter. Put it in a pastry bag and just pipe it onto the radish.
Oh.
And then sprinkle them all with coarse flakes of kosher salt. And that is the cleanest, nicest thing to put in your mouth when you're drinking,
wow,
you know, a cocktail.
Okay.
Okay?
Wonderful.
Other than that, I can't think of a thing.
Well, yeah, we're all your good ideas.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, now when you started me going, there's a lot out there.
There's a lot. And I do have some recipes that I'm going to be following, so I'll send you a couple of those, too.
Oh, I'd love to. And will you send us your packet?
Oh, absolutely.
Every year you send us the packet, and we get photographs, and we get recipes, and we see the invitations. This
little
will be
souvenirs.
Great. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do that.
Will Edith Piaf be singing?
I don't know. I think we'd have to drape the room in black in order to have her singing. So.
Oh, but you know, she was that period, wasn't she?
I know she was. Well, certainly the music of that period. There's a lot of accordion music. A lot of things that you feel like you should be walking a French poodle.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, but we should slip in some Piaf at some point. Absolutely.
I think you should. Yeah. Oh, you know what we forgot completely?
What's that?
That was the era
escargot?
Of the crepe. Well, escargot, yeah. And the era.
Other subject.
Yeah, the era of the crepe.
Oh, yeah,
You know, there could be tiny crepes that you wrap around something interesting.
Right.
You know, I mean, it could, and something you do ahead, obviously.
Yes, and then toothpick them together.
Exactly.
Yeah, I want to try to do that, absolutely.
Just think of one round of Milord from Edith Piaf.
Okay.
Because that's just...
We'll do it in your honor, Lynn.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Have a dynamite party, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Talk to you later.
You take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. I want to make canapes. I haven't done it in ages. Ah, what a great idea. You can call us, 800-537-5252. Food as art, art as food, not new ideas. In the 1500s, Archimbaldo painted these wildly fantastical human heads composed of all sorts of foods. Well, that's pretty tame compared to the modern work of artist Lisa Venditelli. Now, instead of canvas and oils, pasta is her medium, as in a recent exhibit, Mary Magdalene and Friends. Her work has been shown in West Coast galleries and at San Diego's Museum of Contemporary Art. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You actually work in three-dimensional real pasta. Where did this start? How did you come to pasta?
Well, I was painting when I entered graduate school, but I was frustrated by my paintings, trying to say what I wanted to say. I didn't feel like I was getting it through on the canvas. And I started to get interested in artists like Jennifer Bartlett, who had pieces that related back to the canvas, and things that just started making me think about leaving the canvas. And when I got to graduate school, they encouraged me to start making it more personal, and I just started looking into things, old photographs and mementos and things I had from being a kid. And one day I found this picture of my sister going through her confirmation, and there was girl after girl lined up in these little powder blue Virgin Mary type dresses. I applied them to lasagna at the time, because to me, at first I looked at it as sort of a film strip or just this repetitive image that I put across. It ended up being, I just covered an entire wall.
So you actually applied those photos to a strip of lasagna?
No, I actually painted them on. Yeah, what I did was I just used the photo as a reference, and then I copied on and I hand-painted each one. And that piece is called 4,999 Virgini Piccolo, which is Little Virgins. And part of the craziness of it was to paint them individually was when you first looked at it, they all looked the same. And then when you looked at them closer, you realized they were all individual.
I'm just thinking, you're raised in an Italian-American family,
mm-hmm.
women, food, pasta, So much associated with women. Connection here, right?
Yes.
Statement?
Yes, it is. I always use all my work to talk about the female experience. And basically everything that women try to do in my culture, and think in also many other cultures, I think it relates to many other cultures, where women are generally the center of the family, trying to take care of the family and keep it together, as well as sort of modern aspirations of work or the beauty image and taking mm-hmm. care of yourself.
Now, since then, you've done a great many different kinds of things in pasta, but this is such a ephemeral product. Mm-hmm. I mean, how long do they last?
Well, I have all the original stuff that I've made is still intact.
So it is.
I'm not sure exactly how long it'll last, but someone told me the other day, I was speaking to another artist, and she told me how they'd found a bowl of pasta in China that was like over 2,000 years old.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was found in a tomb. Exactly.
Exactly. So it could virtually last forever, I suppose. The idea of it being ephemeral was part of why I began to use it also, because the whole beauty myth and the way women clean and cook and things are immediately, you know, used up. And
and it gets dirty again.
And it gets dirty again.
And you start all over again.
Right. And so that was part of it being ephemeral, but yet they last and last. And I was actually surprised myself how long a lot of it has lasted.
Interesting statement there as well. Lisa, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Artist Lisa Venditelli is based in San Diego. She exhibits in galleries and museums on the West Coast. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought in honor of Halloween. It comes from a headstone in a British cemetery. The children of Israel wanted bread, and the Lord sent them manna. Old clerk Wallace wanted a wife, and the devil sent him Anna. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Additional support comes from A.G. Edwards & Sons, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. A.G. Edwards, fully invested in their clients. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters, Weeknight Kitchen, which is our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle, which will get you baking over the weekend. You can also download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. So sign up for it all on splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with help from intern Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.